The opinions expressed on this show are solely those of Jeremy Hinks and Sticky Jazz Podcast and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else on this planet.
And good day, everybody. Welcome to Sticky Jazz. I'm Jeremy Hinks, the man of a million musical opinions, all of which happen to be correct. This week, I have got the producer extraordinaire, Danny Saber, who has played and produced on more records than I can count, and I still have a lot to dig through. On his resume, produced for U2, David Bowie, he's done Madonna, he's just done a lot of people, but we met recently covering the fact that he put together this the final pieces of Michael Hutchence from NXS. Was doing some solo stuff, and it has now come to the surface. The Michael Hutchence stuff has been released, and we began talking about that. And we actually closed this episode. This is two-part. We closed this episode out on the Michael Hutchence story. So I'm going to open this one up with Danny Saber, having done this with Michael Hutchence. The song is called One Way. So come on, everybody. Let's all do the Michael Hutchence One Way Sticky Jazz.
Let's take a big freedom and drive it around. Take all our friends, rich and poor, mess up this town. If you got the lust for wonder, just let yourself in. We'll keep you safe from morality, so let us begin.
Welcome to Sticky Jazz. I'm Jeremy Hinks, and this week I have Danny Saber, producer to the Rock and Roll Gods. He's been on more, well, geez, I would say he's been on a good chunk of my collection, and so much of what you've heard and seen over the years And I just landed him here today. Welcome to the show, Danny. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, man.
So let's see. You are credited for producing all kinds of stuff, but first questions first. Are you a Hammond organ guy?
Well, of course. I mean, who isn't? But like, are we talking B3, C3? Like, what you want to go? You want to go down the rabbit hole or what?
I was like, because you're credited for organ on everything. So where did you start playing organ first?
Yeah. See, it's funny how things work. I'm also credited as playing on Diary of a Madman and Revelation Mother Earth in 1981, and I was in seventh grade. Like, if it says I played B3, I played B3. But I'm really a guitar player.
Okay.
That sort of somehow dumb lucked his way. You know, it's like funny when I was working with the Stones, because of the Black Grape record, I played most of the instruments on the record. I've always been a multi-instrumentalist, and Mick really liked my bass playing. So I actually got to play bass on two songs with the Rolling Stones, which is just preposterous, because when you think about it, Doug Wimbush and Daryl Jones were in the control room. It's like LeBron and Jordan are on the bench. And
right.
You know, but that's the one thing about music. It's not always about how you play. You know, it's about what you play and the choices you make. And, you know, I mean, I'm decent enough as a player, but like, I'm not on that level. There's people that have dedicated, you know, you know what I'm saying? Like Daryl Jones, when he was 18, he was playing with Miles. Like, and,
right.
And you know, the interesting thing about that, those guys were so supportive and cool. You'd think they'd be like, what the fuck, man? Why is that guy playing? I should be playing. They were the complete opposite, because they're, you know, you're talking about two of the greatest that ever lived.
Right. They're like the Rolling Stones or the gods. And we all know Mick could snap his fingers and have 1,000 most excellent bassists or guitarists standing in front of him saying, pick me, pick me, pick me. Right. So,
well, I always say you serve at the pleasure of the president, dude. You know, those guys, you serve at the pleasure of the president. So luckily he was a fan of the Black Grape record, as was Michael. And that was part of the deal, you know? But that's where the B3 stuff goes back to, is like, when we did the first Black Grape record, you know, by the time they actually let us in a recording studio for 10 days, because it didn't happen overnight, trust me. There was a Hammond C3 at Rockfield, which is a legendary place in Wales. But then it was in like a chapel. You know how studios will have like booths? Like
yeah.
They had this one room, and it was like a magical room. It wasn't a chapel. It was a farm. But I think they took the windows or something, and the floor and the organ. And if you listen to the B3 on the first Black Grape record, it's magical. Everything's magical. And that's the sound of the instrument in the room. Like, you could take that, and it was a C3. And I always remembered that, you know. So I don't really, I'm not an expert on Hammond organs. But, and then when I got to, you know, the second record, I was able to say, I had a whole keyboard rig. We went to Peter Gabriel's place. And in those days, you didn't have the, you know, now I've got soft synths that are amazing. But I had like the old school 70s dude with the B3 and a clav and a Moog. And it was just surrounded. It was heaven. It was synth heaven. It was keyboard heaven, man.
And that was done at Real World too, huh?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, because, well, Real World, I remember hearing they had budget issues at the beginning. Now that they're probably covered, but yeah, they were like stacking that place with so much gear that, you know, everybody who played there, they basically wanted everybody who could play there to play and record there.
Well, they all, you know, that's the legend. Soap paid for that place. When Peter moved, when he bought the place, it was just a mill. It was an old mill. And by the time I worked, because I worked there a lot, I loved it. It was a dream of mine to go there. And they had that U-shaped console and that big, you know, that he had built on that looked like a spaceship. But at one point, I had every room in there booked. And he let me use his personal room, which was upstairs, the original room in the mill.
What he called the box, right? Wasn't that what that first room was called, the box?
That part I don't remember, but it was the upstairs room. Everything's tie-lined. And then he built on a separate room, like off, it was on site, but it was like away from the place. That became his room, because that upstairs room became so sought after. And There was like a box of side quests, and I mean, I was just like the lot, you know. But they all say so paid for that place, so paid for that for what it is today. But he sold a lot of records.
I am a crazy ass Peter Gabriel fan,
Yeah, me
so
too.
I'm
Me too, dude. Me too.
so
I played it. You want to hear a practical joke we played on him once?
Oh, let's hear it.
So, and it won't make any sense today. But back in those days, you know, the first time I ever got on the internet was at Real World. That would have been like 96, 97. That was the first place I ever saw the internet. And you would go on it, and Kermit was a big, like, there was only like 10 websites, huh? There was nothing, there was nowhere to go. But there was this one Robert Anton Wilson conspiracy. So for conspiracy theories, it was heaven, right? And you're on there and you're getting access to all this stuff. So one day Peter's assistant Dickie walks in the studio, and this was the second record, and you know Peter was 10 years into, I think, what ultimately became, I don't know, I think whatchamacallit had out, what was the record with Digging in the Dirt,
Us
Us, what year did Us come out?
92.
Yeah, so Us had just come out, so he was probably like 4 years into the next record, which I don't know what it ended up
Up.
being, because he takes 10 years probably to make a record.
Yeah.
So Dickie walks in and his assistant, and we made like we were fucking with him, and we said, yeah, we just started talking about writing lyrics. And I said, yeah, well, we've got this thing where, you know, you feed this program a line and it gives you back a line. No, it was Peter. Excuse me, I'm fucking the story up. Peter came in and he goes, hey, you know, how's the record going, Peter? And he said, oh, you know, I'm struggling with my lyrics. And da-da-da. I go, well, you know, we got this thing for Sean. You put a line in and it gives you back a line. And he's like, wow, that sounds fantastic, right? And we were like joking, dude. Like, there was no shit like that. And sure enough, an hour, well, it sounds stupid now, because of course there is. But an hour later, Dickie comes in and he's like, oh, we were wondering, Peter was wondering, we get a copy of the lyric writing program. And we were like, oh, fuck, dude. We were joking, dude. We were fucking around. Like, dude, we don't have no lyric writing program. Like, and now, right? And now,
Right. Yeah, now it's
you
just
know, on
that's
AI, you can go on whatchamacallit, and ChatGPT will probably write you a song.
Yeah, well, so I remember Peter was so like, okay, I went and saw Zoo TV a lot. Right? I went in 92, I went to probably a good 16, 17 Zoo TV shows. And I loved the tech. I loved the use of the tech. And Peter Gabriel was really big on, he went a bunch and he saw it and loved it and he was incorporating that. And I went and saw the Us tour, and it's similar,
Wow.
right? Like, whoa, he was going over the top. Peter Gabriel loves technology. And I got, what was his, there was this one software program that he released, and I got, so yeah, it's, I could totally picture Peter Gabriel going, oh, hey, that's so
Yeah,
cool. Let
that
me
makes
dive
all
into
the sense
that.
in the world, you know, if you're Peter Gibb. But I'll give you one other little connection to Peter, and we can move on if you want. So then, when I first started working with Black Grape, it was just me and Sean and Kermit. And we, you know, it was very controlled because of Sean's history.
Right, yes.
And at one point, I remember him telling me, you know, all right, I got this fucking lad from around Oz going to play the fucking drums, right? And I'm like, cool, you know, figuring, okay, cool. Sean's been around. He knows musicians. I'm sure he's a good drummer. So we get this drummer and I meet him. And I mean, he's good, dude. And if you listen to the first Black Grape, like listen to Reverend Black Grape, and the live drums come in, he's playing over the top on a 2-inch. There was no, he's playing to the track. I didn't have any Pro Tools yet. Everything was on 8ats and Akai's, dumping stuff to 2-inch. Dude, you know who our drummer was in Black Grape? Jed Lynch.
Oh
He
my
had,
God.
yeah,
Okay, yeah.
dude. Yeah, you know how good you have to be Peter Gabriel's
To be
drummer?
Peter Gabriel's drummer, yeah, Ged Lynch, him and Jeffrey Orban are the two, like, yeah, those guys
Yeah,
are,
that was our
yeah.
drummer. Like, it's crazy. That was some kid Sean found. I mean,
Some kid Sean found.
yeah,
So,
Jed fucking Lynch.
oh no, I know, I know him from, yeah, because he was he's been on Peter's tab for years since then.
Yeah,
So,
I
yeah.
think this is the first tour he's not doing with Peter. Because aren't they out now?
I don't see there are dates. I don't think they're on the road yet. I haven't so I haven't
I
been.
know there's something coming up. I you know, I'm pretty sure there's something coming up because I think they did some dates last year, didn't they?
They did a couple, yeah, but it's not a full-on tour, you know, because
Right.
when you're Peter Gabriel, you can do what you want when you want.
That's right. That's
Yeah.
right.
So
That's right.
how did you hook up with Sean Ryder? Because you were in LA and he was over in Manchester, and I know he didn't have two nickels to rub together at that time. So how did you get into the game?
You know, he was signed out of Los Angeles, actually. He
Okay.
was signed by Gary Kerfers, but that's not how we hooked up. That was more like a coincidence later. So I started out in a local band called Issa June, and me and Melissa, the singer, we kind of pooled our equipment, and her dad, who was kind of in the business, he was one of the owners of the Hollywood Palace, and he was in show business, so to speak. And they had this really cool house up the hill, up and above in the Hollywood Hills. And in the back, there was like a little kind of, you know, like a clubhouse type of room. And we pooled all our gear, and she had like an 8-track, one of those TX self-contained 8-tracks with the mixer built in
Oh,
and
yeah.
sampler. And like we had a band. So, and then we would make our own demos, but we were like a duo, you know. But then we had a live band around us, but me and her did all the music. So when we weren't working on our stuff, he let me use the place. I had a clicker and I could bring people in and work on demos. So I had my own little production studio in the 80s, which was huge because in those days it was super hard to even get in any kind of a studio, you know. And that stuff was just starting to become accessible. So, you know, they were so generous. And I mean, without that, I don't think I would have ha went on to do what I did, because I had the opportunity to work with anybody that would come over. And then I ended up connecting with a band called Proper Grounds through a guy named Bronx Style Bob and just some local guys that I had met. Jeffrey Connor was our bass player, I think, you know, through a few different people and through Melissa. And Guy, do you know who Guy Osiri is?
I don't.
He's the manager of U2 now and Madonna, but at that point he was still in high school, and he went to high school with Freddie DeMann's daughter. And
Okay.
he had this like, he was the guy, he got like Ice-T to play the prom. Like he was just one of those, at 17, he was like a whiz kid. And he had a little stable of artists, and I was the producer, sort of. He took me on, and you know, he got the A&R gig when they launched Maverick, and he was eight, like 18. So the first band he signed was a band called Proper Grounds. That it was me. It was a similar setup to Black Rite. Me and Sean Kennedy, we did all the music together. And then there was a band sort of built. It was a studio thing, but then there was a band built around it. And being the first band signed to Maverick was a pretty big deal. Madonna like mentioned it. It was on MTV News, our signing. It was kind of a double-edged sword. But then in those days, you know, I had like whatever, 37.5% of the publishing. So it was getting released through Sire. So, you know, I got a publishing deal with EMI. I got EMI to send me to London because my mom's English, and I have a cousin named Richard Frank, who we were kind of on parallel things, but he was the first guy to open cell phone stores in England to the consumer. So he's on a whole nother level now. We always like, when I went there when I was 4 and then when I was 11. So we kind of grew up together. We were the same age, even though he was in London and I was in LA. So he let me bring all my gear. And in those, I had a big rack, you know, it cost like 10 grand to ship my shit over there. And he let me set up in his little flat. And I just started writing over there with people. I always wanted to go to England, you know. And long story short, I met, you know, Guy sort of was really taking off with the A&R thing and stuff, and he wasn't having as much time to manage. So the guy that was looking after me for me and my said, look, if you really want to start working over here, you should have some management over here. So I went and met a few different managers, and I met someone named Shannon O'Shea, and she had SOS, but she had Butch Vig, and Garbage was just, they were looking for the singer for Garbage at that point. So it was a
Okay.
small roster. But dude, like I got so many opportunities, and all of the opportunities I got were pretty much things Butch said no to, because pretty much any record that had a guitar on it after like Siamese Dream and Nevermind, every A&R guy, so who should we get? I know, let's get Butch Vig. Like, so for every record he said yes to, he probably said no to 100. So every record was coming through that place, and they actually approached Shannon for Sean to work with Butch. Which would have been kind of interesting. But because Butch had a team. I mean, Garbage, the Steve Barker and oh Jesus, Duke. The three of them were like, they had a studio, Smart Studios, and that whole thing. That's why Kurt wanted to work with Butch, you know? And out of Madison. So that evolved into Garbage, and then they went and they found a singer. And funny enough, Shirley was in Angelfish, which was also on Radioactive. So Gary Kerfers was kind of responsible for a lot of that stuff. And that's how it sort of evolved. And me and Sean just got put together. It's nothing that crazy. Like the manager said, no, Danny's the right guy for this. And she had really good instincts. She really got me, you know, like, and she saw, like, because I had done a Madonna remix and I had a, you know, I produced the Proper Grounds record and it didn't sell that well, but the reviews and the production got a lot of attention because it was very ambitious. I mean, it was like Metallica and you know, the Beasties, but in like 1991. I mean, you should go back and check out the record. It's pretty crazy. It's metal and but with beats on it. And some guy just wrote a thing recently was kind of nice. He said kind of cited me as the first person to really do that, you know. And the band that we were up against, like there was two bands that were like the buzz bands in LA. And I always tell kids this shit now. You know what the buzz band was that all the labels were looking at us and the other band? You know who they were?
Tell me, who was
Rage
it?
Against the
Rage
fucking
Against the
Machine.
Machine.
You know how
Okay.
fucking good Rage Against the Machine was as an unsigned band? I mean, think of them as an unsigned band having those fucking songs, because they had pretty much all those songs, if I unless I'm mistaken, you know.
Well, they were one of the first crossovers to take, beats and metal and
But
throw
they were
the
still a band.
aggressive.
You know, Tom, and I said this, Tom to me is the last guitar player to really come along and just completely to define his own style. Like when you know it's him, and he took all the sensibilities of hip hop and like transcended them through the guitar, but they weren't running loops and like programming beats and like that. You know, we were like trying to, you know, it was the technology wasn't capable of what we were trying to do, but somehow we kind of pulled it off. And there was a lot of music too.
Even it, when I Tom is the self-proclaimed geek. All right, he's like, look, I'm a nerd who plays guitar like this. I have all these ambitious geeky things. I love the tech of guitar, right? Tom actually, funny enough, but when they toured with U2, he was like, I can't believe I'm playing with U2 and all these like tech geeky things that Edge is teaching me, right? Like, yeah, Tom Morello is one of those. He's a deity
Well, he
as
went
far
to
as
fucking
guitar goes.
MIT. You know, he's like a genius.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know him pretty well. You know, like
I thought he went
we've
to
seen each other over
Columbia,
the years,
but
huh?
yeah, I thought he went to Columbia, but yeah.
No, he went to MIT.
Okay.
He might, maybe he went to Columbia too, but I don't know. Check it. I could be wrong. I'm pretty sure he went to MIT famously. Hope he went to
So
MIT
Zach
now.
went to Yale. I know that.
I
And
know they're smart guys. I actually worked with Zach too on it later, but that was like sort of, you know, we tried it type of thing. But no, Tom was amazing. And but I'm just saying, like, imagine like going and seeing that. You know, and the dance, dance, dance. Yeah, he was doing all the kill switch stuff, and they were just so fucking good, you know, and
oh
like
yeah, no, Tom Morello is I really love that guy's work. And he's so low key. He's just such a mellow, you can't say enough good stuff about that guy.
for sure. So, anyways, that was that was, you know. So you, yeah, go back and check it out sometimes. Proper Grounds. It's interesting. It's way ahead of its time. Too
And
far.
so you were living in England at the time, and then that was 'cause
No, I was living in
after.
L.A. I was always living in L.A. I've never lived in England, but then
Okay.
I started getting a lot of work in England, and I
Okay.
think the longest I was ever there was probably 6 months at a time. But there was a period, and through the 90s, I was there as much, if not more, than I was here. Because I made so many records over there and I was going back and forth, you know.
Okay, so LA was where Black Grape happened, because man, I.
No, Black Grape happened in London and they were from Manchester. That, but they were signed out of LA. The label was LA, but the band was in Europe. But we, the second we did stuff here, it was kind of going back and forth, but Black Grape definitely was a UK thing for sure. Like,
Yeah, because that was I really enjoyed that, like In the Name of the Father, right?
yeah, that was the first, well, the second song that I wrote with him. We wrote that when I went up to Manchester.
Well, it started out like, do you remember the Damned when they did their cover of Alone Again Or, right?
I'd have to hear it, but
The Damned
I've
did a
spent a
cover of
lot of
that.
time with Rat. I've hung out with Rat Scabies a lot, so.
But so it started off like a really psychedelic version of the, it was like if the Damned did Alone Again or a lot more psychedelic, it was really cool. And then it went off on its own. But oh, I really enjoyed that. That was like, oh yeah. 'Cause I remember seeing that like, geez, 120 minutes up there with like, remember when they had that show 120 minutes on MTV?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm tight with Matt. Matt's one of my best friends. Like, we're close friends, me and Pinfield. And like, I always say to him, that's when I felt like when Matt Pinfield introduced your band,
mm-hmm.
that's when the shit became real. Like, to me, because I grew up here, even though we were like at a number one record in England, that was all fantastic. But seeing your video on 120 minutes was like, that was the shit.
Yeah. And I remember seeing it then. I remember seeing that in the Blue Pearl, which was Youth from Killing Joke and Durga McBroom.
Dude, that is so weird you would say that, because the girl I went to write with was Durga.
Yeah, I know Durga.
Oh, did you know that?
No, I didn't know that was who you went to write with, but I know Durga.
That's who EMI sent me to write with, Durga.
Oh,
and then I met Youth because I met the other guy, the singer. What's his name? Not Youth.
Jordy. Jazz.
Jazz.
Yeah.
Because he had a management company when I was meeting with managers. But Durga was the first person I met in London. And Guy Pratt came down and wrote with us. And I ended up becoming really good friends with Guy.
Oh, yeah. Guy Pratt. So he's weird. A champ. Yeah. Andea, no, he's
from the Brand New Heavies. Remember Andea Davenport?
Mm-hmm. I haven't listened to the Brand New Heavies. I haven't listened to the Heavies in a long time. But no, I was just in Rome. I went to dinner with Durga.
Wow.
Yeah, just a month ago, I was with Durga in Rome. Yeah, I went to dinner with her.
Shit, that is so crazy coincidence.
No, Durga is, you cannot, she is, her and her sister are two of the greatest voices in rock and roll. I mean,
what is she doing now? Because last she was...
She's in Rome. She lives in Rome. Well, she splits between Rome and LA. And I've had her and her sister on my show, actually.
Wow, that's so crazy.
But yeah, Durga is, she's still doing a lot of Pink Floyd work.
Oh, good. So she's still touring with them?
Yeah. Yeah. Pink Floyd, Pink Floyd tribute bands. She did a show with Harry Waters. So I was in Germany for the last 6 months, and she was doing a show with Harry Waters up there. No, they were doing one in Rome, whatever. But I couldn't get free from work to go see her.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, so no, Durga is, yeah, so.
Well, send her my best if you happen to talk to her. And I'm going to reach out to her on Facebook or something and just to let her know.
Oh, she sent me a message on Facebook yesterday. So I might as well tell her you say hi.
Please. So, she's awesome, man.
Oh, she's the greatest. We all love Durga, man. But like I said, I remember getting into you and Blue Pearl like that. Just on there, but I didn't see a lot of press about Black Grape here in the States, right? I mean, I remember seeing it up there on 120 minutes, but like I remember going to the raves and still hearing different remixes. Every time I went to a rave, I heard a new remix of Naked in the Rain by Blue Pearl, right?
Well, yeah, but that was that song, right? That song was when the sun was coming up at the rave. That was the song. That was the song, you know. And what's interesting about the whole thing with the Black Grape with like America versus Europe is too, you got to realize something. So in England, and see, Sean really wanted to break America. You know, it really mattered to him. But just from a like economic thing, and it's not even the artist gets caught in the middle. You've got Universal, I guess, or I think they owned it. They were on Radioactive in the States, but then MCA owned it, which I think was owned by Universal. And then you have a number one record in the UK. You can headline six. We headlined Reading. We had, you know, we're headliners. And then you got to come to the States and do 3 weeks or a month and lose money. So mm-hmm. It's like, it's a really hard. And that's why so many bands from Britain back then had a hard time breaking through here, because the only ones that really did it in a massive way were Oasis. If you think about it, I don't even think Blur were that big here. I mean, they, you know, they did well because, you know, they had that record, you know, the song number, what is it? Song number three, like that's a classic, but like, it was a hard, like, and it wasn't the artist. The artist was caught in the middle. Usually you had the agendas of all the different, and then sometimes there may be split management. And so that was what it was sort of up against. By the second record, we were poised to really do well here. Because we could play like 1,000-seaters. Like when we played in L.A., instead of doing one night, say, at the Palace, we did 3 nights at the Roxy or 2 nights at the Roxy and had 1,000 people outside trying to get in. You know, like, so But it was a smart move because, like, created a buzz and everyone was excited. And Sean's kind of an icon. You know, every scallywag from Britain would come crawling out from under every rock to come see us.
To come and see Sean Ryder.
So, yeah. So, you know, but on the second record, we were really poised. We had a bit of bad luck. When the last show we did was at Irving Plaza, and it was amazing. We actually ended up playing the set twice, right? Because I would tour. I didn't have to be there at every show, but I played most of the American shows. And Lars came, and they were headlining Lollapalooza that summer. And Lars offered us like a killer spot on Lollapalooza. But then Perry was launching the Enid tour. So
wait, what year was this? Give us the year.
This would have been 96, 7, somewhere in there. So
Perry, I was in Europe during that time.
The first year of the Enid tour.
Yeah. Okay.
And so we got offered 30 dates on the Enid tour, and then we got that Lollapalooza. And, you know, the powers that be decided we're going to go with Perry, you know, it's the new, because Perry started Lollapalooza, but this is going to be the new. Long story short, by the time it came time to do the tour, 28 days got canceled off the 30 days. There were only 2 dates of that Enid tour. So we picked the wrong tour, or our managers picked the wrong tour. So they to bring the band over to do 2 shows, like
it would have been a bankruptcy move. Yeah.
Things like that that are so out of your control. And that decision was probably made 6 or 8 months before the dates, you know, but that's how the cookie crumbles, you know? So that really fucked us up. I don't even think we ended up having an American tour on the second record.
Oh man. Yeah. Like there's so many, a thousand other bands.
Yeah,
have similar.
So there's so many things out of your control that have to go your way that people never even know about, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many great bands that were poised to get huge, but the power, just bad timing on everything, you know.
But Sean just, and then we'll move on, but Sean's just fine. I mean, he's like a national treasure in England, you know that, right? Like he's got shows about.
Oh yeah. Nick Durden, I had him on my show. He wrote a whole chapter about Sean Ryder, basically Sean, how he didn't think he was ever going to survive it all, right? And then he did, and then he was like, now what am I going to do with myself? And now he's out doing what he's doing, you know? I mean, kudos to Sean. He from where he was, he's done really great. He's really, really done good for himself. So
he's a good dude, you know, he really is. He was because I was lucky. He was really the first any taste of real success I had. And believe it or not, he was one of the best role models I could have ever had. Like he showed me the ropes the first time I've ever talked to a journalist. And I learned so much from him because he was, by the time I got there, he was pretty seasoned dude. You know, like, you know, they had done some big shit, you know, they were a big deal.
Oh yeah. They were ready to explode cultural. In the States.
And they
were
really the band that connected rave culture with the mainstream. One of them, you know?
Yeah.
So
riding on New Order's coattails. Yeah. I mean, it just, they were, oh man, there's, you and I could talk 1,000 bands that could have been, should have been huge that just didn't because of some asshole at the label office somewhere. Just, you know.
Yeah. And in fairness, there was plenty of our, you know, when I say us as a group, Black Grape, that didn't help. Like, so, you know, Sean wasn't like completely innocent, but there's the business, like on the business side of things. And like, that leads me to Michael, you know, and that's why I'm in this position, because when Michael did the Max Q record, it was at the height of In Excess's success, you know, Michael needed an outlet outside of the band, just creatively, like as an artist, because when bands get that big, I've said this, but you know, and it's not a knock against anybody, it's just a fact of nature. When you become that big, it can feel like you're trying to maintain what you have more than taking risks and keeping to grow. And Michael was the kind of artist that needed that buzz from working on music and stuff, right? So he was always trying to push it out. When he did the Max Q record, you know, they were like, yeah, man, whatever you want. That was the height of In Excess's success. And of course, the record, you know, got buried. They didn't want him compete. So when he went on to start to do new, like, he's like, you know, I'm going to take another crack at this. He made sure he kept control of everything. He didn't take the devil's money, as they say.
Well, I call that, so when a band reaches critical mass, right? You know, it's I call it critical mass. When they get really big, it's how long did it take for them to get there, and do they stay there or do they collapse, right? And so many bands, if they reach critical mass on their second or third record, you're never going to hear them on their fourth, you know? and INXS reached critical mass at the right time to go where they did, right? And they were outstanding. No question about
they
made that.
Some, but... And I'm not going to start getting into that because, like, I don't want. But you know, they had a couple of opportunities. If they had taken, things might have been a little different. But who knows? I mean, look, if you really think about it, in the history of rock and roll, let's just say, but in all artists, really, there's never been an artist that hasn't gone through what I call, thanks to Julian Temple from the Joe Strummer Unwritten. Have you ever seen that movie, This Future is Unwritten?
I haven't yet, no.
Watch it. Joe was going through his wilderness years when we met him, and every artist is Sinatra. Elvis had to make a comeback, for God's sake,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So everybody goes through that, you know, but there's only really been two bands, if you think about it. And then you could get to second tier, like I'm talking the Stones and U2.
Yep.
That every time they do anything to
it's
this
gold,
day,
yeah,
it's on the cover of Rolling Stone. And it's like, it's cultural. The Who, Pink Floyd, all, yeah, they might have sold more records, but like, it made just, and it's an impossible thing to do. It's you can't even choose to do that.
I was gonna say, like, U2 and the Stones.
They broke, as Keith says all the time, they broke up in 69, maybe 70. I've kept it. You know, they okay, fine. They you know, they're the standard. The Beatles are the gold standard, no doubt about it, especially when it comes to record making. But as far as sticking it out and managing to not kill each other and break up. There's only two that and maybe I'm missing one, but that I'm talking everything. U2 goes to Vegas, opens the Sphere. Like, it's a cultural moment, dude. They're setting the table for the next 100 years. You know, people will be going to see U2 in 100 years. They won't be there. There'll be like AI versions of them, but that's mm-hmm. where it's all going, you know?
Well, there was, it's, on that in just a minute. Let's talk about the Michael situation, right? So
okay.
here was my thing, and the guy who introduced us, you know, our mutual friend there, I talked to him about this. I had a real hard time with INXS, with Michael's vocals on the hits. Okay. I liked them, but I didn't like the hits. I hated What You Need. Mm-hmm. Need You Tonight, New Sensation, right? It was when Michael would be like the I'm lonely, right? That was like, to me, that sounded like nails on a chalkboard. Okay. But the other stuff that where Michael is just, I'm gonna sing and just do my thing, that was what was outstanding. And I love that in the early days of INXS. And then the hits he kept cranking out was doing this stuff that I really couldn't grasp. I was like, this is annoying, I don't like it. And then when you guys gave us Max Q, they played that on the radio here in Salt Lake all the time.
Oh,
and
really?
I loved it. I loved the Max Q.
And by the way, just to be clear, Ollie Olsen did the Max Q record. I hadn't come into the picture yet. That was before I met Michael. But yeah, it's a fantastic record. It's a great record.
Oh, it's a great record, right?
Michael was really proud of that record, you know, and it didn't stand a chance, you know.
And
like
so,
and
so
it could have done really well, you know.
It could have, yeah. Well, they played it here a lot in Utah. We had a radio station. We had three that were just trying to carve out their own little corner of the new wave alternative world. And Max Q got a lot of play here. But I loved Max Q for the fact that he wasn't doing INXS, right? And that's probably
right.
Why they got buried, like you said. So when I heard this new song, I was like, oh, wow, this is really fantastic. Not, you know, not the new song, like, sorry. You know what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Heard it and was like, this is the best I've ever heard out of Hutchins since basically Don't Change, right? I mean, this is fabulous.
Well, look, let's not get carried away. I appreciate that. And look, there's no right or wrong. You're the, I've been saying that from day one. You know, there's a reason though. I'm going to tell you why you feel the way you feel. I think there's a reason that connects back to it. But let's start with INXS. I'm not going to knock INXS, bro. Everything that I'm doing, it's all rooted in the meaning comes from their success. And look, they were really good. And
oh, yeah.
One thing that I grew to really appreciate them was because, you know, when we found the song Surface and then the whole idea, let's make a documentary, you know, Julian Temple. That's how I met Julian, because I was tight with Joe, and I was actually supposed to be interviewed in the film, but I waited 10 hours and finally had to leave. But I'm in there a little bit playing the guitar. But I got to know Julian, and I said, hey, listen, I got this Hutchins stuff. We're trying to get a film made. Julian came on board, and we went into like a research thing. He didn't ultimately direct the movie, but we amassed, you know, because this is pre-internet. You couldn't just Google everything. So he had a researcher, and we had a little budget, and she was amazing. And she put together, you know, 100 DVDs. I got them right there in a bag. And I went through them. That was my job when we finally got this last rock star made, was to kind of more get rid of the stuff that wasn't relevant to the story. Mm-hmm. So I've seen every piece of, you know, MTV News, whatever it may be, every performance of that band. And I really grew, because I was never a huge fan of INXS, to be honest with you. All I knew was Michael was the guy, all the girls, you know, I had two girls I dated who were like in love with him before I ever even knew him. So, that's, but here's the thing, and this is what you're picking up on. In any band, I don't care. It's not, this is not a knock on INXS. It's just a fact of life. When a band comes from a garage and takes over the world, everybody owns a piece of that, right? And you have these big hits, and everyone's in the studio, and there's a collective sort of, it's like a committee sort of a vibe, right? With the way I worked, and Michael told me straight up, it was so liberating for him, because we only had one rule. There was no rules, and there was nothing we wouldn't try. But when you're filtering your ideas in the dynamic of a band, and there's a guitar player, and there's, you know, everybody's got their role to play, and they have their little plot of land. But when you're making a record and everything, the only reason it's there is purely to serve the vocal. And Michael, I had this with Alice Cooper. I had the similar experience with Bowie, where with Bowie, it was very similar, where I put a vocal up and I started playing guitar to it. It was a remix. If you listen to those Little Wonder remixes, the slower one, it's like the space out. And I get to be like, it's like Cowboys and Indians, Reeves used to say. I get to take it wherever I want to take it as a fan, right?
All right.
And it's the same with Michael, with working together. Like, he sings some, it's, you know what, dude, that's a guitar part. Or, hey, man, I got this idea, and he'd hum me whatever it may be, because he wasn't a conventional musician, but he had a head full of friggin' ideas. And this was all there to serve him. So I think maybe that's what you're picking up on a little bit, but it's not a better or worse, or I'm going to do this now and I'm not going to do that. It's just having an opportunity to use some muscles you might not get to use as much in this situation, because the success is built on the dynamic of these. And there was a bunch of guys, and there was like, what, 6-7 guys in that band?
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, the world sees Michael and the 6 Australians. But trust me, I'm sure in the dynamic of the band, they were a band. They were brothers. They were all equals.
Mm-hmm.
So he had this, he needed that outlet, because he was really driven by that. He's compelled, real, you know, like that's the one thing I think all these great icons have in common, is they're compelled. They're not doing it because they're chasing this or they want to be that. And I think that's a big part of what's missing, because of the way the value system has changed, especially around music. You know, the talent show is now the paradigm, where when we were kids, a talent show thing was like, you know, I was ditching school, smoking weed, you know, getting arrested or something. I dropped out, like, you know, and I got to play bass with the Rolling Stones. The guy that did the talent shows living in a trailer somewhere. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, now it's all, everything's different. It's not better or worse. It's different. Let's just say that. So that's what you're picking up on, I think, a little bit. So
You're saying, was Michael feeling very comfortable in it?
No, not at all. In fact, it's the opposite. He needed something outside of it to
In the recording. Recording.
He was starting, to get lost in the, you meant in the recording.
Yeah, in the recording. He sounded like he was just.
Yeah, no, he told me. He said, he was like, this has been so liberating because again, there was nothing was off the table. It just, all that we cared about was, and I try to do this with everybody I work with, you know, it's just, let's just chase the best idea, you know, and where it takes you. Cause sometimes you walk in with an idea. I got an idea. Cool. And then sometimes, you know, you go to you end up stumbling on some other shit. It's like every great advance in mankind has probably come from a mistake or like some unintended circumstance. It's just having the ability to recognize it, the wisdom, and then the ability to, you know, the skills to build on it. So, you know, that's really what was about. And nobody was like getting caught up and standing their ground creatively. It's just let's go where it takes us. And nothing, you know, and my thing with Michael was always like, you know, you could look at Michael as the love child. Most people would say, like, if you were going to reference, you'd say Jagger, Jim Morrison, right? But I
Yeah.
always saw him a little more Robert Plantish, you know, because he has that sort of bending own key. And if you listen to it, man, it's there. And so I was always trying to be Jimmy Page to Robert Plant, let's say, but maybe a little heavier than
Okay, yeah, all right,
necessarily,
yeah.
you know what I'm saying? Like, then, you know, and I think that's where, like, if you listen to One Way, it's like, dude, those are harder. The guitars are as hard as they can be. And, you know, there's certain things that are going to always complement Michael's voice, but those have got to be the heaviest guitars he's ever had on a record. And there's a couple songs on the solo record, like, there's a girl who's been like puts up songs and listens to them. And one of the songs she put up was Show Me How You Make Me Feel. And that's all me in the middle trying to be Dave Navarro, doing all that, like, sort of. So it's like Jane-Z, that's like my wheelhouse. Jimmy Page, Dave Navarro, like lots of delay, a little bit of Robert Fripp maybe, and Blue, like Eboe, like that's my
Dude, you're
wheelhouse.
naming off all the gods right here. I'm like, yeah,
Yeah,
Robert
those
Fripp,
are all my
Bo, yeah.
references, you know, but those aren't necessarily things you'd think of necessarily with NXS, but they work with him. I mean, Adrian, could you imagine Adrian Belew and Michael Hutchence? Oh, that would have been a monster motherfucking
Oh,
situation.
that would have been, yeah. Well, Baloo's back out. Have you seen Baloo's back out?
Yeah, but Belew's one of the funkiest motherfuckers that's ever. I mean, he's my favorite rhythm, one of my favorite rhythm guitar players of all time, you know?
Yeah, I always felt like, yeah, Adrian Belew, Robert, any of the King Crimson family are like, you know, just worship them and let them be, you know. But so what, why just the story behind this song and why it took so long to convince to get it released, or you know, could you talk about that a little bit, I think, because there's quite a story behind there.
So Michael initially reached out to me because he was a huge fan of the Black Grape record. He had been sort of between Max Q and what ultimately became the V2 record, let's call it. He, you know, was just again looking, you know, for whatever he was looking for. He was chasing whatever he was chasing, you know, and he was trying stuff with different people. He had his own studio in south of France. He had a little work studio. So he was just, you know, and he had ideas and he was throwing stuff down and he built up a batch of material that I had never heard when he was alive. I didn't even know it was around. And then, you know, he approached me. I went to London. He finally kind of got traction with Andy, and him and Andy Gill had been writing. And they had a batch of songs, like I'd say six or seven, let's say, which that was what was initially sent to me to see if I wanted to work with him. And then he called me, and it took about 30 seconds on the phone with the guy because he was the most charming, amazing dude. But I didn't know that yet. And he was so cool and so humble. And I was like, yeah, man, you know, and I like the songs. I had heard the song. In fact, I found it. There's a fax of me replying, just saying, it says, fuck yeah, fuck yeah, fuck yeah. Like, because I really liked, and I was a big fan of Andy Gill's.
Oh, well, yeah, Andy Gill is a god at
I
the board
didn't
too,
really
man.
know I was. I mean, I knew I wasn't deep in the Gang of Four. I knew the songs you would know, but he's the first guy that ever gated a guitar. Like Andy's style, again, blue. He comes out of that like it's a weapon thing, which is sort of, I'm big into that. I always was. And I just loved what I was hearing from them. So I'm like, cool, yeah, I'm in, you know. Plus, it was the first offer I got. So I took it like it was work. But you know, Michael was the first big international rock star. And it was kind of cool because he was sort of in a, you know, it was a, you know, it was a little bit of a down cycle, you know. So to me, I looked at it always as a challenge and it excited me. And I went out to London and we sat down and we connected immediately. And Michael was always very like, I think by the end of the second day, He just sat me down and, we were at, took us all out to dinner. And he's like, dude, I just want you to know, like, I'm so happy. And this is like everything I hoped it would be. And, he just was always very transparent. It was never any of this telling you one thing, and which I learned later.
So he's much different than the ego that the image was about him then.
Dude, this, first of all, Michael was super highly intelligent, dude. Like, he grew up in Hong Kong. He was really well read. I mean, he was way smarter than I was. Like, I was just a kid, some dumb kid. And he was like, that was part of his persona, was this Bond-esque sort of character that he was trying to create. And the notion that he was just some lunatic swinging from the chandeliers, it was really insulting, like, to me when in that movie they made, and the guy who played Michael was good, but there's a scene where, and it's true, it's based in truth. Andrew's like toiling over the, what I think became Need You Tonight or whatever it might've been. And he's got this track, and and there was pressure on them to write hits because INXS split everything as a band. And I think they finally got to a point where they said, look, all the singles are coming from Michael and Andrew. You guys are going to be the focus of the writing, right? And he's touring and he's finally got it. Now, where the fuck is Michael? And he can't find Michael. And he gets on an airplane and he goes to Hong Kong, which is true. And he knocks on the door and, some chick answers. And he walks in and it's like a fucking harem. And Michael's there like with the fucking opium pipe and 20 chicks around him. He's like, Michael, you got to write the lyrics. Michael goes, give me the tape. Goes upstairs, comes back 10 minutes later, and he's got a number one hit. Now, that may have happened. But if that did happen, and I'd like to think it did, it's because he spent 20 fucking years getting to the point where he could go upstairs and write a hit in 10 minutes. Like, do you see what I'm saying? The guy, he was the real deal, man. Like, and whatever. So, yes.
Okay. Yes. All right. on something else you said, I'm a huge Gil fan. Okay. Huge Gang of Four fan. I accidentally dialed into a bridge call for an interview. They gave me the wrong one. I called in and somebody else was interviewing Andy. So I just sat and listened for 10 minutes and I freaked out. I'm like, that was great. But the other, I asked Barry Anders and Shriekback. I don't know if you're a Shriekback fan.
I know Shriekback. Sure. I remember Shriekback. I'm not like, and I can't run off there. Like
they're one of my all time faves.
What was their big hit? They had one big
Nemesis.
Song.
Nemesis yeah. was their big yeah. one. But they're traded.
Australian too, right?
No. They're from Sheffield, England.
Oh, they're from England. Okay.
I asked Barry and Shriekback, because they had traded members with Gang of Four on and off over the years. And I said, hey, so is Andy Gill really difficult to work with? Because I've heard he's hard to work with. And he said, no, this is what he said. Now, you're going to laugh when I tell you this, okay? He said, no, Andy's great guy. He's always been right by me. Terrific guy. He said, but I'll tell you one thing about Andy Gill, though. He does not suffer fools. I said, what do you mean? He said, you better know what you're doing when you walk into the studio. That's it with Andy Gill. I said, you mean he's a perfectionist? And he says, no, Andy starts with perfection and finishes with Andy Gill, right? He said, Andy, when Andy sits down to make something happen, he's going to make it happen and it's going to be magic, right? Because he's okay. just, but he said, no, perfectionist, no, that's where Andy Gill starts.
Well, look, let's just leave it at that. The bottom line is this. It's like the difference between, let me just make sure I set this up right. It's like the difference between a perfectionist and a pain in the ass is somebody who sold 20 million records, right? Like,
well, that's Andy Gill, yeah.
When, Seal following Kiss from a Rose was a perfectionist.
Yeah.
But before Crazy, he was a pain in the ass, trust me. So like, It's all perception. But look, the one thing I will say about Andy is this. He was a pure individual, meaning Andy was Andy. And, everything that came out of him, he reached that level, right? Like he could, as an artist, because sometimes you got to separate the person from the artist, right? I mean, yeah. I think that's a big problem in the world today. People are like trying to remind, like, look at people, how they, it's like, doesn't take away from the art they made, whether you love them or hate them, right?
Ike Turner.
I think people get too much credit for things and get too much grief. Look, just look, the art's what stands the test of time. And Andy definitely contributed something that nobody else did and left it behind on an instrument that it's like I was saying, Tom's the last guy I could really say has done that, where it's like, you brought something to the table that wasn't there before that came directly from you. And Andy's one of the most influential guitar players. I mean, ask Edge, you know, like so many
people.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
You know, so like I said, it doesn't matter if I knew certain, I was influenced so much by the Edge that that's what I meant when I said I didn't even realize it until I realized it. Oh, shit. So when Edge is telling you, you know, it's like, yeah, okay, I get it now. You know, so yeah, Andy definitely deserves a little place in the on the mantle.
Place. Oh, Andy
He's
Gill,
got his
absolutely.
Own little
yeah.
area, unless that's what I would say, you know. And everybody's experience is different, you know. But he was British. He was very painfully British, you know. And look, I don't know when those guys worked with him. Maybe like they worked with him earlier than I did. Like I worked with him a little later. So, you know, it was like, it depends. Like when you get people sometimes, that can really affect your perspective on and where you're at and where they're at. You know, like when I
but
worked with Michael.
Andy had the Midas touch. And but everyone said, no, he was great. He just, you're perfectionist. And, you know,
well,
but
yeah,
he wasn't mean. He wasn't rude. He was just,
no.
Hey. I'm going to make this happen.
He was not a mean-spirited person at all. But
yeah,
like I said, let's leave it at that. That's a nice way of putting it. And I'm not.
Oh, Andy was the best.
The whole point of this is, like, again, to spread a little positivity and hopefully get people to remember Michael, you know, for all the great reasons people were to remember him. And now that the dust has settled and, you know, he never kind of made it. He was going into those wilderness years. He just didn't make it out the other side. He would have been fine. You know, look at Duran Duran. Look what all those bands are now. They would have been no different. NXS would have been in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 10 years before all of them. If Michael,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So.
No, I just remembered I was in Paris and it was a Saturday evening and I had just finished doing some stuff with some friends, popped in to catch the BBC's midnight broadcast of Top of the Pops. And they had just finished with, you know, In Memory. And they played one of the NXS songs because it had been number one that week. How many years earlier? And then they said, to the memory of Michael Hutchins. And I was like, wait. And he had died that day. I was like, oh, man, you know, that one hit. That was, you know. But, yeah, I mean, even Springsteen loved it. You know, Springsteen got NXS on stage when he was in Australia and they played
Did
Don't
really?
Change. Yeah. Like,
what was that?
Last time he toured, probably about
so
20. Yeah, when Springsteen was touring in Australia, he got them on stage to play with him. And
somebody
showed
me a thing of him doing one of their songs now that I think about it.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, it was.
That's right.
And that ties it up for the first episode with Danny Sabre. If you think he had some great stories this time around, just wait till next week because he's got more. Oh, so much more. We'll be talking about U2 and David Bowie and the Rolling Stones in there. So, everybody, for the moment, enjoy this one. This is the Black Grape hit, In the Name of the Father, and take care. And well, special thanks to Barry Andrews of Shriek Barrett for letting us use the theme and title of Sticky Jazz.
Your father and your Christ. Make the gal fall out, oh Jesus Christ.